I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, the protest song was a powerful and essential tool during the civil rights movement, serving as a rallying cry against brutality, tyranny, and systemic injustice. These songs were more than just music. They were a source of strength, unity, and resistance. The very act of singing together fostered a sense of solidarity among protesters, giving them courage and reminding them that they were not alone in their struggle. Protest songs served multiple functions. They informed, instructed, recruited, entertained, and left a lasting record of the movement. Today on The Source, how protest songs empowered the civil rights movement and how they can be used again today as a new generation takes to the streets demanding justice and accountability. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
From the John L. Santico Studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies.
People get ready. You don't need no baggage. You just get on board. All you need is faith. Don't need no ticket. You just thank the Lord.
The song People Get Ready was released in 1964 by The Impressions, written by Curtis Mayfield. He said he was inspired by Martin Luther King Jr.'s March on Washington and his I Have a Dream speech. Mayfield not only captured the spirit of the march, but also created a song that caught the mood of the times and injected hope. King then named the song the unofficial anthem of the civil rights movement, and often used the song to get people marching or to calm or comfort them. Mayfield wrote People Get Ready at a time of major change in America. Segregation had divided the nation along color lines. The right to vote was being denied in the South and in Texas to African Americans. There was unrest about the war in Vietnam. Women were demanding equal rights. And changes did not come overnight. It took years of struggle, and that struggle continues. Songs like People Get Ready were essential in many of the long protests and marches. Stephen Stacks takes a look at how post-1968 freedom songs helps us negotiate our present relationship to the era, while also at the same time sustaining the contemporary struggle inspired by it. His book is The Resounding Revolution, Freedom Songs After 1968.
There is a consensus memory, kind of a dominant narrative of the civil rights movement in U.S. Society and U.S. culture that puts that timeline from, you know, kind of 1954, the Montgomery bus boycott is usually the beginning of that timeline. And then the end is usually somewhere between 1965 and 1968. Lots of things happen in 68, including the death of Martin Luther King Jr., of course, that kind of placed the end of the timeline there. And I, in my research, became interested in initially when freedom songs, the kind of traditional freedom songs from the civil rights movement, were sung after the fact. So the performance that really initially grabbed my attention was a performance of We Shall Overcome that was done at a congressional commemoration of the anniversary of the passage of the Civil Rights Act, I believe. And it was just a really strange performance, and it just had me asking what is going on here with the kind of competing understandings of the meaning of this song, of the meaning of the civil rights movement in general. And so that kind of led me down the rabbit hole of, well, what happens to the music of the civil rights movement after the movement, quote unquote? And how can that teach us about maybe how we've misremembered the civil rights movement and the end of it in particular, where this music continues And what other music we probably should have been considering as part of the civil rights movement all along, when that is happening. And so it's kind of a snowball effect for me of understanding how sanitized and oversimplified our understanding of the civil rights movement has been, and all the effects that has had on our contemporary freedom struggles in US society.
What you said about we have this overly simplified idea of what the civil rights movement was. And what we have is this cinematic view of it. And I think we're realizing that today as we're seeing a new generation of people who are protesting what's happening with the Trump administration. And they're realizing protesting is hard. This is this you just don't show up and things change. So what do you think they're missing out?
Sure, yeah. So I think, again, this narrative that we have that kind of, Rosa Parks just had this idea to sit down on the bus in Montgomery, and that started this chain reaction, really leaves out so much of the nitty-gritty organizing that was happening, of the really day-to-day grind of organizing, and the community building that it took on the local level to make all those things possible. And I think that, one of the problems is that we have this narrative that really emphasizes the great men of the civil rights movement, like Martin Luther King, that give us this kind of, as you say, like cinematic overview effect. But really, what Martin Luther King would kind of travel to different areas and speak and inspire, but the people on the ground were the folks who had put in the legwork, the hours and hours and hours, to make those things happen that King was commenting on and pushing ahead. So I think what we miss is that those behind the scenes, that behind the scenes organizing. And the songs are a part of that, because the repertoire of freedom songs, like This Little Light of Mine, Over My Head, Wade in the Water, We Shall Overcome, songs like this. We're in the lifeblood, and we're sung in church and in community settings. There was a kind of common well, especially in the Black communities in the South, of music that was available, was able to be drawn on and pulled out in the moment to augment what was happening. But you have, the years and years of cultural and musical development that went into that moment when the song comes forth at a protest. And so I think a lot of folks miss that. Yeah, it takes really steady, concerted, long-term effort, and it takes knowledge of history and of the resources that are available to us. And that's one of the things that I think current protests sometimes don't take advantage of.
Stephen Stacks is the author of the book, The Resounding Revolution, Freedom Songs After 1968. We continue our conversation after this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davis. Stephen Stacks is the author of the book, The Resounding Revolution, Freedom Song After 1968. We're talking about the power of song in the civil rights movement and beyond. When I've got to cover these new protests, that they don't understand the physical importance of everyone singing together. It does a lot. When everyone is singing these songs, you are providing a commonality. You're having this communal event. We're all breathing together. We're swaying together. We're forming a bond. While simultaneously, there is an instruction, especially with the call and response, of what this protest is all about.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you're right about that, with the protests that happened with George Floyd.
There's a lot that goes into the problem that we have currently. And part of it is that, you know, we simply have fewer and fewer of those spaces where people learn a kind of common repertoire of songs. And so it's becoming harder and harder to call out a song and have, you know, the majority of people around know it. So we need teaching, as you mentioned. We need call and response. We need people who are going to lead groups that may not have the same resources available to them in this type of activity. And yes, absolutely. We have had several moments recently in time where the need for this type of activity has risen to the surface. 2020, of course, being a really pivotal moment, recent history of the Black Lives Matter movement. Which particular instance are you thinking of when you mentioned George Floyd?
Lean on Me.
Sure. You know, in the wake of Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and George Floyd in 2020, you of course had a rash of protest actions happen, and the performance of Lean on Me that you're thinking of was one of those. And I think analyzing those instances, we get a sense of different meanings for music. That so Lean On Me being a good example of a song that may not necessarily have a political connotation on its own, but when it's introduced into a certain context, all of a sudden takes on new meaning. And that's the same kind of thing that civil rights movement protesters in the 1950s and 60s were doing. They were bringing music that may or may not have had a political connotation outside of it, but bringing it into the context of movement activity and drawing on it and improvising on it and adapting it to that moment. And that's what made a lot of those protests so powerful.
Well, there is that, you know, crossover, because there were some popular songs like Lean On Me, but thinking also of like Martha and the Vandellas singing Dancing in the Streets, that's in 1964, that's before your book, though. You know, that was seen as, that was a popular song, Motown, but also was, people saw that as a call to go out in the street and protest.
Yes, certainly. And so you have songs like People Get Ready by The Impressions that were, you know, other soul hits like that, that were popular music, of course. But provided a soundtrack for people and framework for people for movement activity. Change Is Gonna Come will be another very, you know, well-known example. Many of the tunes by somebody like Nina Simone as well, that are songs that, you know, Nina Simone, of course, made some that were particularly about civil rights movement events. But also, you know, hearing a Nina Simone song on the radio had a layers and layers of meaning for folks. And so
If you could get it
popular
on
music.
the radio.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. That is, well, if you listen to the radio at all. So this is another, we're now in a moment where our listening practices are so individualized that, again, finding a common repertoire is a challenge. But I don't think it's an impossible challenge. I think it's one that we really need to drill down on if some of these movements are going to mobilize the resource that group singing has.
Contrast like Nina Simone, she was unblinking, unflinching, driving. She said what she meant and she didn't hold back. And it was, you could hear the power and the commitment in her voice. And then you hear the People Get Ready by the Impressions. And, you know, Martin Luther King, I had read, had thought that was one of the main songs of the movement. And he really embraced it. But that song is sweet and almost like too nice.
Yes.
So what about comparing, you know, I mean, do the protest songs, I mean, by having something that is so smooth and palatable, does that take away from the message?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I'm thinking of two aspects to this that are important. So number one, there is this division that is a part of that dominant narrative of this memory of the civil rights movement, where you have the kind of 1964 moment where young activists really start to get tired of how slow progress is happening. And there's this kind of rising accent on self-defense, on a little bit of a more aggressive approach. You get Black Power coming into the movement politics, and Nina Simone has kind of long represented that, musically represented that aspect of the movement from the late 60s. And I think we have overemphasized the distinctions between, rather than the commonality between, say, like a Malcolm X figure and a Martin Luther King. They really were much more in line than they were not. And so I want to be careful not to overemphasize, like, Nina Simone's music being distinct from, say, the Impressions. However, absolutely, you're right that that there is a different feel to Nina Simone. And I would say, as a kind of interesting example, when King was assassinated, Nina Simone, her band performed 3 days after that at the Westbury Music Fair. And they sang a song that they wrote in the immediate aftermath of King's assassination, called "Why the King of Love is Dead," and it's an extremely powerful articulation of really the grief and the ambiguity of that moment for people, no matter where they fell on the ideological spectrum of movement politics at the time.
Well, the murders never cease. Are they men or are they beasts? What do they ever hope to gain? Will my country is it too late for us all? And did Martin Luther King just die in vain? Cause he'd seen the mountaintop. And he knew he could not stop. Always living with the threat of death ahead. Folks, you'd better stop and think, 'cause we're headed for the brink. Now that he is dead, he was for equality for all people, you and me, full of love and goodwill. Hate was not his way. He was not a violent man. Tell me, folks, if you can, just why was he shot down the other day? He'd seen the mountaintop.
And so I think you see in that performance that although, you know, Nina and others may have accented things differently, there was an affection and a solidarity with people like King as well. And so we would do well to kind of remember that while there, of course, were kind of a constellation of beliefs, that the movement was always diverse. It was never as univocal as we sometimes remember it.
And so let me put in here that the song Abraham, Martin, and John, which came out in 1968, and it too was a pop song sung by Dion, a former teen idol, and it seemed to be appealing to white audiences. And so it's like, what are we doing here? And bringing people together, onboarding them who maybe otherwise would not be motivated by a Nina Simone.
He freed a lot of people, but it seemed good they die young. You know, I just looked around and he's gone. Anybody here seen my old friend John? Can you tell me where he's gone? He freed a lot of people. seen the good they die young.
Stephen Stax is the author of the book The Resounding Revolution, Freedom Song After 1968, published by Illinois University Press. We're going to continue our conversation after this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Stephen Stax is an assistant professor of music at North Carolina Central University and is the author of The Resounding Revolution, published by the University of Illinois Press. We're talking about the protest songs that defined the civil rights movements of the 1960s and 70s and what they can tell us today. And what about today's music as protest songs?
I talk about this in one of the chapters of my book of the problem of white participation in the movement. We do need, I would say, on-ramps. I think that's a great way to put it, for people who maybe aren't forced to live the freedom struggle day in and day out. So in particular, you know, white people who need some way to engage. At the same time, that engagement has in the past been forced to happen on white people's terms. And that is when things become a problem. So, you know, this sometimes is negotiated through music in the movement. So the, for instance, insistence on singing a song such as We Shall Overcome after it has, kind of waned in its meaning for some segments of the movement is an example of kind of this, what I would call as a kind of counterproductive nostalgia for something that really never existed, which was this very, you know, this picture of a super unified and multiracial coalition that never had any disagreements or any problems. And so I think it helps sometimes for us to remember that the civil rights movement was complicated.
Yeah.
It wasn't that different than what we are trying to negotiate now. And we have got to find ways to remember that it was messy, it was confrontational, it was occasionally violent. And so when that stuff happens now, we should not use that to discredit the current moment and the current movement, but we should understand that this is the way that movement work always has been. And we should find ways to build coalition together. And I think coalition is a good way to describe what needs to happen to bring white people on board as well, is that we work on the things that we have. We don't deny our difference. We don't downplay our differences. We celebrate them and we work together on the things that we can work together on.
It does seem like there is an effort to weaponize the false memory of the civil rights movement. And you see this all the time, especially on the Martin Luther King Day, where Republican politicians will go on social media and they will quote Dr. King out of context in a way that will fit their agenda. But, you know, he would never, I imagine, would be down with that.
Absolutely.
But this idea is like, oh, that was the civil rights movement and it was fine and was orderly and everyone was all on board, painting over or whitewashing over the conflicts and the messiness of it seems in order to serve the idea that protests today are not going to be effective.
Absolutely. And I talk about one instance of this from the first Trump presidency, the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. As an example of what I call the, what you're describing, I call the 1968 lens in the book, which is this idea of filtering any instance of protest that happens now through this faulty memory of the civil rights movement, and then using that to then hamper or delegitimize the current action if it doesn't live up to this faulty memory that we have of the civil rights movement. And so, yes, of course, quoting, it seems like many politicians only remember one line of one speech that Martin Luther King gave, and use it to justify colorblind politics, which is, of course, not at all what Martin Luther King was advocating for. And I think that sometimes the music itself, when it's loaded with this mismemory, is done a disservice because it's not as if these traditional freedom songs are necessarily have to mean that protest is, say, passive or is geared towards accommodating white people. That is not what these songs meant at the time, and it doesn't have to be so now. If we can kind of recover the fullness of what the movement was about, then maybe these songs become relevant again, in addition to all the other music that protesters are adapting in the current moment as well.
Well, I wonder about dipping into that songbook. These are the songs of the baby boomer generation and not really something that the young people today might respond to. Even something
Sure.
like Public Enemies Fight the Power, that song, how old is that song now? 35 years old?
Yes.
I'm waiting to hear it when I walk down the dog food aisle at Walmart and they put it in Muzak or something.
And so I think we have to pay attention to what music is being used and is meaningful in the current moment. So I'm thinking of protesters adapting Kendrick Lamar's All Right, the refrain from that song to protests into a kind of chant, we're going to be all right. We're going to be all right. Or Janelle Monae's song, Hell You Talkin' 'Bout, which features kind of chanting and singing. The sung refrain is a very singable, approachable tune. And in between, you get the names of black men and women killed by police or vigilantes shouted and then say his name, say her name. Those are both powerful examples of kind of new music being used in the movement. But I also think there's older songs that, yes, they come from the boomer generation, but are more radical than we remember. I'm thinking of a version of the tune John Brown's Body, which for most of us is associated with the Battle Hymn of the Republic, but also got some words during the Civil Rights Movement era that I think most young people today would read and still think are radical, which is "Move on over, or we'll move on over you," and that those were penned by Lynn Chandler in 1965, and explicitly inspired by John Brown. So I think there are some resources from the past that might still shock people with how radical they still sound. At the same time, we do need to pay attention to what music is being mobilized, what new music is being mobilized by protesters today.
But when Sam Cooke, what was that, 1963, 64, change is going to come. I mean, we've been waiting for that change. Marvin Gaye, how long has he been asking what's going on,
What's going on? Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, they're great songs. The objective is to do what? What should they be generating new songs out of what is happening today?
I think that there's lots of movement scholars and others who would say that activists and such who would say that art and expression are integral parts of any vital social movement. And it doesn't necessarily have to sound the way that traditional freedom songs sounded, but this movement does need its poetic expression if it's going to sustain itself and if it's going to inspire participation over the long haul. And we're kind of fighting against a cultural milieu that is very, who that has a short attention span. And I think that some of that artistic expression can generate a longer term engagement. And that's, so again, it doesn't have to sound a certain way, but it's, we certainly do need songs and musical engagement with this movement if it's going to coalesce and accomplish what it aims to accomplish.
Is the song, as the ones you write about in the book from, you know, 1968 on, do you see them as documents of a time?
I do, but I think that a lot of what we have, the way that both scholars and kind of the public have conceived of freedom songs is as this kind of historicized and circumscribed repertoire. And that has its uses. It's important to note how these songs functioned in the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s. But what it sometimes obscures is how music has continued to be important to what happens after 1968. So one of my main arguments in the book is that we need to think about freedom singing as an activity, not just freedom song as a genre, as document, as you say, as a, you know, a collection of documents about this historical movement. But what is in continuity with that movement now and since 1968? How is, say, how are the protesters in the Warren County environmental justice movement that I discuss in the book from 1982, how is what they're doing both the same and different from what was happening in the 1960s? How is the way that Bernice Johnson Reagan, who was in the SNCC Freedom Singers during the movement, but then did several things after the movement that were different, that cultivated a new political approach to freedom. How does that teach us different ways of musically engaging with movement politics?
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Stephen Stacks looks at how post-1968 freedom song helps us negotiate our present relationship to the era, while at the same time sustaining the contemporary struggle inspired by it. His book is The Resounding Revolution, Freedom Song After 1968, and we'll be right back. This is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We talk about the civil rights movements in a historic context, that they are part of the past, when in reality, they never ended, but the singing did stop. Maybe it's time for the singing to start up again. Songs that demand equality, economic justice, and freedom for all. Stephen Stacks is the author of the book, The Resounding Revolution. There seems to be two streams feeding into the protest songs of that era, and they come from the Black church, also mm-hmm. from labor movement.
Yes.
And they came together, and then they were adapted at protests, and people would sing them. I mean, if you're going to be at a protest for hours, you need to make the time, you know, move. You don't want to be standing around doing nothing for hours. Singing helps that time move forward. How do they orchestrate that? How do they put that out there? You know, when the Roots sing, "Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Around," I mean, that's a labor song that was used
yes.
in the... So they're able to pull that forward, modernize it, but also at the same time recognize, you know, its legacy.
Sure, absolutely. And I think, you know, the only thing I would add to the streams there is that, you know, popular music has really always been a third stream there, kind of feeding into the yeah. civil rights movement. And so I think that one of the things that we maybe don't have enough of now to make singing as and music making in general as prominent as it was then is that we don't have as many folks trained to lead singing. And also people, public singing is becoming less and less of a thing that the general public is able to do. I mean, the occasional performance of Happy Birthday and the kind of mumbling through the national anthem is what a lot of people have experience as far as singing in groups goes. And I think that it's, we are going to have to make intentional effort to bring that education from where it used to exist in these institutions, to bring it directly to people.
But when I talk to some young people, I mean, they can rattle off these rap songs. They, you know, they know that.
And so I think that's another thing for us to consider, is that it's not just about so I agree with you, what you stated earlier, that there is something unique about group singing, and what it generates for a social movement. At the same time, I think it's important to pay attention to the musical practices of both young people, but also just people in general in 2025. And I think that there is a role for private listening practices that feed into movement politics. So when I talk to my students at North Carolina Central about protest music, they tell me a new song that I haven't heard of every time I have this conversation, from usually a hip hop artist that I know of but didn't know the song, or things like that, that they are listening to. And so I think there's so much music, and it's both immediately accessible, but also if it's outside of what the algorithm feeds you, it's hard to find sometimes. So there's a lot that is kind of forming people as individuals. But what I see lacking is music, except for with some exceptions like Kendrick Lamar's All Right. What I'm hoping to see here soon is some music, any music, doesn't matter the genre, that kind of provides that group experience that both unifies and inspires, and as you say, gets people breathing together, because that's something that really does generate a different kind of energy for a protest, and for a social movement.
And during the March on Washington in 1963, where Martin Luther King delivered his I Have a Dream speech, they had Peter, Paul, and Mary, Harry Belafonte, Joan Baez, Bob Dylan, just to name a few of the many performers that were there. They were part of the entertainment and also creating a scene where you wanted to be there, not just because of the political action that was being taken the but also because it was a show.
Certainly. And I think that's something that we also forget in our kind of mis-memory of the civil rights movement. And this is something that I think has developed over time as we've de developed a canon of what music was, quote, important to the civil rights movement. And we tend to emphasize the stuff from more kind of folk contexts. And I think that we should not ignore the role that commercial musicians play in movement politics. I think of somebody like a Beyonce, who anytime Beyonce does anything political, there is, there's fire coming from all sides. From the left, Beyonce is often accused of being overly commercial and not really invested in freedom and movement politics. And from the right, of course, there's all kinds of critiques of Beyonce anytime she does anything.
Yeah, anything.
But yeah, that's right. That's right. There's a
Literally
particular,
anything.
yeah, there's a particular performance that, it in this is 15, 16 time frame when Formation had come out, and the song in and of itself lyrically doesn't necessarily suggest that it was related to Black Lives Matter, but then the music video added that layer of meaning to it. And then Beyoncé's performance at the Super Bowl, in garb that kind of was a callback to Black Panther aesthetics. That really,
The movie or the political action group?
the political activist group, including a kind of the X across the chest that was, some interpreted as a reference to Malcolm X, but some interpreted as the extra, the bullet clips
Bandoleros.
exactly that Black Panthers used to wear in the street. And so I think that that act alone was certainly something that should be seen in conversation with these artists of the past who were using their platform and leveraging their music making to further political, to raise political consciousness, and to, of course, it's also entertaining. But is that mutually exclusive? And I don't think that it is. I think we should also pay attention to how commercial musicians and entertainers are leveraging what they're doing for movement politics.
Stay tuned, right? I think we're at a moment. We're kind of like holding back, looking to see what develops. I think people will, the elastic response is there. Something will come back.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that you see when you kind of examine the history since 1968 is that one of the things that, making music in freedom movement context does is that it always adapts and absorbs new contexts and new meanings. And when I talk about, for instance, the Warren County movement in North Carolina, I talk about how they were able to kind of marry environmental action and Black freedom and civil rights concerns by drawing on the tunes that made that connection explicit. And I'm also thinking of the current moment with the with immigration justice,
right?
And how songs like Muunika from the Peace Poets and songs that are bringing these two movements in conversation. I, for instance, have led the singing of Bernice Johnson Regan's song Ella's Song outside of an ICE detention facility, and so these movements are kind of coalescing and are able to speak to each other and strengthen each other, which is exciting to see.
You just reading the headlines, the songs write themselves. Hell no, I don't want to go. Don't send Abuelito to Guantanamo. It's just right there. Come on.
Yeah. And I think that I feel certain, my experience from my own research is that I think the music is happening somewhere. What we need to do is find where it's happening and understand its meaning and,
and get it in the algorithm.
Point, yeah, exactly. And maybe at some point we will, some of this music will reach a broader audience and begin to kind of coalesce a movement in the same way that.
Right. And so that's the other thing about protest songs. It does make you feel less alone, that you are hearing somebody that they're feeling what you're feeling, the anger, the anguish, the frustration, the desire for something better. And so you're getting affirmation.
Yeah, absolutely. And Bernice Johnson Regan, one of the great singers of the movement who went on to start Sweet Honey in the Rock, and to be the curator of African-American culture at the Smithsonian, just a towering figure over the 20th century. She used to talk about how singing is taking up space, and that when you sing together, you are taking up space and making statements to those in power that you shall not be moved, to quote the song, right? That this is our space, and singing does that in a way that many other things can't do. It sends the sound of you beyond you, right? So that other people can connect with it, and so that those who are trying to contain you can also be impacted by it. So it does have a unique power that, I think that the current moment and the current movement would do well to mobilize.
Stephen Stacks is an assistant professor of music at North Carolina Central University and the author of the book The Resounding Revolution, published by the University of Illinois Press. That's it for this edition of The Source. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
You just thank the Lord.